Over the following months, there was employment for all, and much besides to plan and arrange. The main work on the fort was completed, including the extension to the warehouse to accommodate the abundance of captured ivory. Sarah was able at last to bring her furniture ashore. She set up her harpsichord in the hall, which was to serve as the dining and common room to both families. That night she played all their favourite tunes, while they joined in the choruses. Tone-deaf Tom made up in volume for what he lacked in tunefulness, until Sarah tactfully distracted him by asking him to turn the pages of her music book. For lack of grazing, such a great number of cattle could not be held in the immediate vicinity of the fort. Jim split them into 7 smaller herds and ordered Inkunzi to move them out into the surrounding country as far as 20 leagues distant from Fort Auspice, wherever good grazing and water could be found. The Nguni herders built their villages close to these new grazing grounds. "They will form a buffer round the fort," Jim pointed out to Tom and Dorian, "and they'll give us good warning of the approach of an enemy before they come within 20 leagues." Then he added, as if in afterthought, "Of course, I'll have to ride out to inspect them at regular intervals." "And that will provide you with a fine excuse to run off hunting elephants," Tom nodded sagely. "Your devotion to company duty is moving, lad." However, after only a few such expeditions, the elephant responded to Jim's attentions by moving out of this country and vanishing into the fastness of the deep interior. Within a month of their arrival at Fort Auspice, Jim and Louisa waylaid Sarah in her kitchen. After a long and emotional discussion, which left both women in tears of joy, Sarah went off immediately to speak to Tom. "My oath, Sarah Courtney, I know not what to say," said Tom, which she knew was his most forceful expression of amazement. "There can be no mistake." "Louisa is certain. Women are seldom mistaken in such matters," Sarah replied. "We shall need somebody to splice the knot and make it all shipshape and legal," Tom looked worried. "Well, you're a ship's captain," Sarah pointed out tartly. "So you have that power vested in you." The longer Tom thought about it, the more the idea of having a grandson appealed to him. "Well, it seems Louisa has passed her trials fair enough," he conceded, with a convincing show of nonchalance. Sarah placed her fists on her hips, a storm warning. "If that was meant as a jest, Thomas Courtney, it fell far short of the mark. As far as you and I or anyone else in the world is concerned, Louisa Leuven will be a virgin bride," she said. He gave ground rapidly. "I am convinced of that, and I will fight any man who says different. As you and I are well aware, premature birth runs strongly on both sides of our family. On top of that, Louisa is a comely and likely lass. I dare say our Jim would have to sail a long way to find another better."
"Does that mean you'll do it?" Sarah demanded.
"I suspect I'll not have much peace until I do."
"For once you suspect correctly," she said,
and he picked her up and bussed her on both cheeks. Tom married them on the quarter-deck of the Sprite. There was not space aboard for all the company, so the overflow watched from the rigging of the Revenge or from the palisade walls of the fort. Jim and Louisa spoke their vows, then signed the ship's log. When Jim brought his bride ashore, Mansur and his men fired a salute of 21 guns from the cannons of the fort, which scattered the Nguni warriors in confusion and reduced little Letty to hysteria until Bakat could reassure her that the sky was not falling in upon them.
"Well," said Tom with satisfaction, "that should hold them until they can find a priest to do the job properly."
And he doffed his captain's cocked hat and exchanged the job of clergyman for that of bartender, by knocking the bung out of a cask of Cape brandy. Small boy slaughtered an ox, and they roasted it whole on a spit on the beach below the fort. The festivities went on until it was consumed, and the brandy cask was at last drunk dry. Jim and Louisa began work on the construction of their own private quarters within the walls of the fort. With so many willing hands to join in the work, it was less than a week before they vacated the wagon that for so long had been their home, and moved under a thatched roof between solid walls of sun-baked brick. Then there were darker matters to address. Rashud was brought out in his chains from the cell in the fort, which had originally been intended as a cellar.
Dorian and Mansur, who were, by the law of Islam, the judges and the executioners, took him into the forest far out of sight and earshot of the fort. They were gone for only a few hours, but when they returned, they were grim of countenance, and Rashud was no longer with them. The next day, Tom convened a session of the family council. For the first time, Louisa Courtney attended as the newest addition to the clan. As the eldest, Tom explained the decisions that faced them. "Thanks to Jim and Louisa, we are heavily overstocked with ivory. The best markets are still Zanzibar, the factories on the Coromandel coast, or at Bombay, in the realm of the Great Mogul. Zanzibar is in the hands of Caliph Zain al-Din, so that port is closed to us. I will stay on here at Fort Auspice to conduct company business, and I will need Jim to help me. Dorian will take the ships north, laden with as much of the ivory as they can carry, though I doubt that will be even a quarter of our total stock. When it has been sold, he has even more pressing business in Muscat." He looked at his younger brother. "I will ask Dorian to explain it to you." Dorian removed the ivory mouthpiece of his hookah from between his teeth, which were still white, even and without gaps. He looked around the circle of well-beloved faces. "We know that Zain al-Din was ousted by a revolutionary junta in Muscat. Both Batula and Kumra were able to obtain certain confirmation of that on their last voyage to Oman. Kadim ibn Abu Bakr..." Dorian's handsome features darkened as he pronounced the name of Yasmini's murderer, "purported to bring me an invitation from the junta to take Zain al-Din's place on the elephant throne and to lead the battle against him. We don't know if the junta are truly trying to find me, or if it was merely another lie to try to entice me into Zain's clutches. In any event, I refused for the sake of Yasmini, but in attempting to protect her, I condemned her to death." Dorian's voice faltered, and Tom cut in gruffly.
"You are too harsh on yourself, brother. No man living could have foreseen the consequences."
"Nevertheless, Yasmini is dead by Zain's orders and by the bloody hands of Kadim. There is no surer way for me to avenge her death than by sailing to Oman and throwing in my lot with the revolutionaries in Muscat."
Mansur got up from his stool at the foot of the long table and went to stand at Dorian's shoulder.
"If you will allow it, I will sail with you, father, and take my place at your right hand."
"Not only will I allow it, I will welcome you with all my heart."
"That's settled, then," said Tom briskly. "Jim and his bride will be here to help Sarah and me, so we'll not be short-handed, and we can spare Mansur. When do you plan on sailing, brother?"
"The trade winds will give way to the monsoon within 6 weeks. The winds should stand fair towards the end of next month," Dorian replied. "That will give us time to make the preparations."
"We will strip all the remaining cannon out of the ships to give you more burthen for the ivory," Tom said. "Besides, we can use them here in the fort to bolster our defences. We can never be certain that Kesa has not smelt us out. Then there are these marauding Nguni impis sweeping through the land. Jim has routed one group under Manatasi, but we know from the fugitives who have come into us that there are others just as savage running amok out there. Once you have sold the ivory, you will be able to buy new guns in India. There are handy armourers in the Punjab. I've seen their work, and they make excellent 9-pounders, just the right weight and length of barrel for our hulls." When the guns had been lifted out of the schooners, and all the powder and shot with them, they were ferried ashore in the longboats, dragged up the hill by teams of oxen, and set in the earth emplacements around the fort.
"Oh, that should do nicely." Tom eyed the new defences with satisfaction. "It'd take an army with siege machines to subdue us. I think we're safe from marauding tribes, or even from any force that Kesar might care to send against us, once he gets wind of where we are."
Relieved of the cannon, the schooners rode lightly at anchor, showing much of the copper sheeting on their bottoms.
"You'll soon find ballast to restore their trim," Dorian promised, and he ordered the loading of the ivory and the refilling of the water casks.
Since Yasmini's murder, Dorian had been cast into sudden moods of deep melancholy. He seemed prematurely aged by grief. There were new strands of pure silver in his red-gold hair and beard, and fresh lines deeply etched in his brow. But now, with a definite goal in mind, and Mansur beside him, he seemed rejuvenated, once more abounding in vigour and determination. They began to load the ivory aboard the schooners, and to lay in fresh stores and top up the water casks for the voyage ahead. The pickle barrels were refilled with sides of beef from the captured herds, and the hulls of the two ships settled deeper in the water. Dorian and his captains, Batula and Kumra, agonized over the trim to wring the best speed and handiness from them. "Until we have new guns to defend ourselves, we will have to rely on speed to run from any enemy that we encounter. Despite our father and brother Tom's best intentions and effort 20 years ago, there are still pirates at work in the ocean of the Indies. Keep well offshore from the African coast. That's where they have their nests," Tom advised. "And with the monsoon in your sails, you'll be well able to outrun any pirate dhow." They were all so busily employed, the women ordering their new homes, Tom and Jim occupied with the cattle and horses, Dorian and Mansa making the ships ready, that the days sped by. "Does not seem like 6 weeks," Jim told Mansa as they stood on the beach together and looked out at the two little schooners. The yards were crossed and the crews had gone aboard. All was ready for them to catch the tide on the morrow. "It seems these days that we no sooner set eyes upon each other than it's time to part again," Mansur agreed. "I have a feeling that this time it'll be for more than just a short while, cuz," Jim said sadly. "I believe that an adventure and a new life await you over the blue horizon." "You also, Jim. You have your woman. Soon you will have a son, and you have made this land your own. I am alone, and I will seek the country of my heart. No matter how many leagues of sea or land come between us, I shall always feel close to you in spirit," said Jim. Mansa knew how great an effort it had taken him to make such a sentimental declaration. He seized his cousin and hugged him hard. Jim hugged him back just as fiercely. The two schooners sailed with the dawn and the tide, and all the family was on board the Revenge as they cleared the mouth of the bay. A mile offshore, Dorian hove to, and Tom and Sarah, Jim and Louisa went down into the longboat and watched the two ships sail on and grow tiny with distance. At last, they disappeared over the horizon, and Jim turned the longboat back for the bay. The fort seemed strangely empty without Dorian and Mansa, and they missed their marvellous voices at the family sing-songs around Sarah's harpsichord in the evenings.